Hello and welcome back to the history of video games. My name is Ben and I'm joined by the one and only Wes. How you doing today, Wes?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Ben?
I'm doing pretty good, man. I had some shows this past weekend and I'm glad to be done with them now.
Yeah.
I'm ready for some games, man. It's been too long.
Means more time for games, and that's what we're here for, you know?
Yes. I just installed a new game, which I'll leave it a bit of a surprise. Yeah. But it's a pretty big one. It's not like it's gonna take me that long, but it was like a big AAA game at the time, we'll say.
So nice. Okay.
I'm very excited to play it. It's got some slaying demons action. I'll tell you that much.
Oh well, I think I can guess what's going on, but well,
we'll see.
Leave that for later. But I mean, speaking of slaying demons, slaying monsters, I can get us started this week with what I've been playing recently.
Okay.
I've been playing some more Witcher 3. You know, still going with it. Put down Pokemon X for a little bit and trying to really push through Witcher 3. And I finally got past the point where I'd been when I played it way back when in, 2017 or whatever. There's like the two main kind of intro areas, Velen and Novigrad. And after that's the Skellige Isles. And okay. I think last time I played it, I just had like side quest fatigue or something, because I wanted to clear up all the side quests before I progressed to the Skellige Isles, and I just never made it there. But this time, I did go through, went through all those side quests, cleared up all the ones that were under whatever my current level was at the time, and now I'm in the Skellige Isles, and it's such a cool change of pace. I kind of thought they were going to be tiny, because they're islands, but they are a huge area to explore. And the theming of it's kind of cool too. It's like Arctic almost, and the people there are more like Vikings, very different from the city people that you weren't interacting with in the city of Novigrad. And so I've been enjoying that a lot. I'm starting to feel the little bit of like open world fatigue kind of thing. You know, there's just so much to do and so much to explore. But being in this new area is helping, because I want to explore all of it. It's not this area that I've been doing side quests in for like 30 hours. It's new and it's fresh. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all I've been doing with it right now. You know, just chugging through that. I still have a lot ahead of me in the base game, but then also in the two large DLCs that I purchased that thankfully are post-game. I kind of like how that works out. I can just leave them for after I finish the main story quest, but I'm looking forward to getting back into it. You know, hopefully next time I have an update about Witcher, it'll be about me finishing the main story at least. But I'm not gonna lie to myself, that's probably still like 40 more hours off.
Yeah, well, if it does happen, definitely let us know, because I haven't, like, I have The Witcher, played it a lot, but I've not gotten anywhere close to the end of the story, so I'm definitely curious to know how it wraps up.
If you
like it. I don't even know if there's multiple endings or what's going on with that.
I think there are. Yeah. Okay. So I'll definitely let you know. We could compare notes when you get around to playing through it.
Okay. Yeah. I'll have to put it on the list.
Nice.
But speaking of the list, I've been playing some games, trying to get them off of the list.
Right.
The list is actually growing, because just yesterday I checked Prime Gaming, which I have Amazon Prime, and I think I picked up BioShock Infinite, Deus Ex Human Revolution. Gosh, what else? There was like two other, a Mafia 2,
and
something else, like another fairly big one, all for free. So I was like, well, I guess these are on the list now.
Yeah, that's a lot of good games too.
Yeah, but okay, I didn't play any of those yet. The one I did play and I can talk to you about today, Wes, is a pretty good one. It's called Driftland: The Magic Revival. And this is one that I actually ended up enjoying a lot. It's one I've never heard of before, some little indie game. But it's actually a real-time strategy game. And if you know me, you know I love my real-time strategy games. They're some of my favorite games of all time. But unlike something like StarCraft II, which I enjoy a lot for being just incredibly, almost a stressful experience at times, but one that demands your full attention, this game was obviously trying to hit a different kind of market and different kind of player base, which is a little bit more of a casual RTS fan. And to make the game casual, it kind of did a couple unique things that I've not really seen before. So to kind of describe it a little bit, you first have to know that, like, when we talk RTS games, we usually refer to them in terms of macro and micro. So macro is like base building and economy management and like upgrading stuff. And then micro is more like you actually controlling individual units and getting good engagements and stuff. But this game almost completely removes micro from the equation. So instead of actually commanding your units, like you don't have any control of them over, like at all. So like when I build a knight or whatever in this game, he's just going to walk around the castle and live up life.
Interesting. Okay.
You know, by himself. Now, if my kingdom does get attacked, he'll defend it by himself, which is nice. But if I want to actually tell him, hey, go attack the enemy, what I do is I actually set a bounty on an enemy location, you know, kind of a, like a group of enemy buildings, essentially. And I put like a monetary value on that bounty that attracts my warriors to go and attack it. So if it's a small bounty, then only one or two of my guys are going to go attack there. But if I have 20 guys and I set a bounty 20 times higher than the smallest price, then they'll all go and attack it. So that's kind of how you control the units. It's kind of an indirect control. And then once you set the bounty, they will go and attack it by themselves. They'll, you know, go into the engagements, and once their health is low, they'll try to remove themselves from the engagement, go back home and heal up at base, and then go back out again. So you don't really have any direct control over the combat in this game. I actually kind of like the system a lot. Like, I felt the AI was good enough so that, like, you do have deaths where the enemy was able to snipe a guy before you could come back home, but in general, they do a pretty good job of coming back home and resting up and then going back out again. It kind of almost made the fights feel a bit snowball-y in a way because of that. Like, either I was slowly gaining the upper hand in the fight, or I would slowly lose, and eventually I would cancel the bounty and, you know, heal back up, get some additional units or a bigger army, and then try again. But that's kind of how the combat works, and it's a more approachable way of doing it, right? It doesn't take your attention nearly as much. You can just be looking at the base screen, you know, building fisheries or whatever it is that you're doing on that screen, and the war is going on in the background, but it's happening. Like, you don't really have direct control over how that goes, so you don't have to worry about it as much. But that's just like one of the main mechanics of this game. This game has a lot of really cool mechanics. The whole theme of the game is like, the world that you're on is like a mystical, magical world, but the world has imploded. And so all of the pieces of the earth are now floating islands in the atmosphere, which is really cool. And so they're really cool. And when you start the game, always, your like main base is on a fairly good-sized island, but that island, because it's an island, has limited resources. So like the resources in this game are things like wood and stone and diamonds. Mm-hmm. But you're going to run out of resources, or like your island might not even contain all the things you need. So to get more resources, you have to connect other floating islands to your main islands by building a bridge in between them. And that allows your units to move across and allows you to take those resources of the island when you put a bridge down. But you can't just like build a giant bridge between these islands, and they're kind of far away sometimes. The islands have to be close to any other island in your empire to build a bridge. And so what that means is that you actually, to build a bridge to these islands, you actually need to move them to your collection of islands close together so that you can build that bridge. And to move them, you actually have like god powers in this game. And some of them are like offensive god powers. Like you can like call down like a fireball from the sky and snipe a unit or something. But some of them are like just you can actually move the island in the map. And this makes a whole bunch of really cool ideas as far as gameplay goes, where like you don't have to attack the enemy's main base to win. You could just like try to siphon off one island at a time, right? Like attack the outskirt of their base, destroy the bridges to it, and then move the island physically away from their base to connect it with your own, to like physically steal the land, which I think is just such a cool mechanic and idea. And it works really well in this game. I love that about it. I thought I kind of played through all the main campaigns of this game, which there's a couple for each race of the game. There's, I think, four races, but they all play pretty much the same. It's just more of an aesthetic thing. But I played the main campaigns, and they had some good ideas. Like, there was this mission where your main base, you weren't allowed to build bridges, so you had to use your god power to just move your main base around the whole map to attack the enemies, which was cool. So they had some really unique ideas like that, but I felt like they could have gone even further with it. I think in, you know, it versus the CPU, it was just another mechanic in this game, but I think against a human-controlled player, like a PvP game, the creativity that you could do with moving your islands around could be super interesting. You know, like, do you try to build, you could build like a line of islands that's like straight, right? Or you could build more of a circular thing. Like, I don't know. So there's, I think, a lot of possibility for creativity there. And overall, it was just a really fun game. Obviously, a little bit more on the easy side. You know, I didn't have any problems with it. And there's even a fast forward button, which for an RTS game is very weird, but there's like some downtime sometimes where there's not too much going on. You're just kind of waiting. So I actually use the fast forward button a lot, and I'm really glad it was there, but it kind of just shows you like this game, it has a couple different ideas from all sorts of different genres, but they kind of meld together in a very cohesive way that makes sense for this game. And I was just really, happy playing it. It was really fun, and every time, you know, I saw a new mechanic, I'm like, oh, that was such a good idea. Like, I don't know, they all just fit together so well. So
nice.
I was really happy with this one. I thought it was really good. So I would definitely recommend it, especially if you're into RTS games like I am. Even if you're not, it's a perfect one to hop into as like a first starting point. So yeah, it's called Driftland: The Magic Revival. Definitely check it out.
Very cool. I mean, I love sky islands, floating islands kind of stuff, and the idea of tethering them all together to make your empire or whatever it is sounds pretty sweet. It's very cool. I'm going to have to check that one out, I think.
All right, so let's head over to the special topic for today's episode. We fortunately could kind of go back a couple months and check out something that we've been meaning to talk about for a while, because there's finally like 1 week where there's not something important going on in the history of video games. There's not like a new piece of hardware. So there's an old piece of hardware we're going to take the time to talk about. This is actually the successor of the Commodore PET, which, you know, came out in 1977. So it's been a couple of years. I mean, Commodore has come out with a couple other computers in that time. So what was different about this one, Wes? What can you tell us?
Yeah, so the computer's called the CBM-2, Commodore Business Machine 2. I think it's what it stands for. Why they didn't call it the PET-2, I'm not too sure. But it's an 8-bit computer, and it feels to me like it might have been trying to fill a middle ground. I don't know, between like the Commodore 64 and the PET. It was designed to be the baseline for several different formats and variations, and the two main series that it was going to have were the P series for personal computers and the B series for business computers. But also, it very much feels like a successor to the Commodore PET, because the CBM-2 was compatible with all previous Commodore peripherals. So any of your floppy drives, printers, whatever that you already had from the Commodore PET, you could use on the CBM-2 as well. Some interesting stuff about this: early on in the design process, Commodore had planned for Porsche to design the cases for the new computers, go for that sleek, fast design, I guess. But they ended up being too expensive to contract, so they went with someone else. But because of this like rumor that got out, I guess, that these cases were going to be designed by Porsche, their smaller cases that didn't come with an onboard monitor were described as Commodore Porsches or something like that. So,
okay.
Not technically designed by Porsche, but people, you know, that still, that idea still went along with it. But talking about the B series for a little bit, the business series computers for CBM-2, there were two main variations. One was the Slimline, that was just the computer with a built-in keyboard and no monitor. And then the other was the High Profile. It had an attached monochrome monitor. But oddly enough, you know, even with all these plans for this new computer and the B series and all that, the P series didn't really take off, and Commodore actually decided to not sell it in the US because they were having so much success with the Commodore 64. I guess they felt like, oh, we already filled that market. Like, entering the P series into the US market, no one would be interested in it. So I believe they did sell some P series in Europe, and there were a few that made it out in the US, but they were eventually recalled, and only a few exist today. The B series, though, did end up being sold in the US, and mainly it was the B128 configuration. I think that was probably the cheapest configuration of them. And unfortunately, that didn't sell too well either. So later it was going to be liquidated and sold for pretty cheap as a bundle with a bunch of peripherals by a company called Protecto Enterprises, who apparently for a couple years after it came out, put ads to try and get rid of the, you know, remaining inventory of the B128 computers. Part of the reason that this computer also didn't take off is that these computers were expensive to manufacture and apparently difficult to make software for, which feels like a very deadly combination for a new computer on the market. So didn't have maybe the market going for it, but I'm really curious to hear what was in this computer, you know, what separated it from the PET. So Ben, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. And obviously, since it's the successor of the PET, I'll try to compare it to the PET specs to see what was improved with this one. Now, the PET used a MOSTEC 6502 CPU chip in it, and this new version used a 6509, which is just like an enhanced 6502. So pretty much the same CPU in it as the Commodore PET, but just a little bit more enhanced. So it had that small upgrade. It also, probably the biggest upgrade it had was the amount of RAM in it, because the Commodore PET originally sold with 4 kilobytes of RAM, which is terrible. Now, you know, by 1982, I'm assuming the models were probably being sold with more RAM than that by default, but still not a whole lot. Whereas the CPM2 line sold with 128 kilobytes as the lowest amount of RAM that it came with, which is much, much, much better. And it could be expanded even from there. Something else that was also a bit better was the resolution. I mean, the Commodore PET, it had a resolution of 40 by 25 pixels for its main graphic mode, and that's just not very good. Whereas the new CBM2 line was 320 by 200 pixels, so way better, and 16 colors. So it was not just a monochrome, which the Commodore PET was. So the visuals are already way better on this. Nice. Also for sound effects, it was also way better. The original Commodore PET just had the beeper channel, and the CBM2 line had 3 sound channels in it, which actually used the same chip as the Commodore 64, which, as we know, has great sound effects on it. So I would say those specs are kind of top of the line. You know, like they're quite good in pretty much every respect. Probably a little bit weaker than the Commodore 64, but obviously, you know, way better than the PET. But yeah, it's just kind of weird. Obviously, the personal computer version of this doesn't really come out in the US, and because of that, there's no real games made for this version of the Commodore PET in video gaming history. The business version did come out, but as you can imagine, you know, people only wrote really business software, and I don't really know that the business software was that enhanced with being in color and having like right. sound channels. Like that's not gonna be good for your Excel spreadsheets. So yeah, I don't know. It was just kind of a weird computer. I don't really know where they were trying to put it in the market, but the market's fluctuating so much right now. I mean, they've got the VIC-20. They've got the Max machine for like a couple months, you know, and then the Commodore 64. And I don't know if you remember, but Commodore is kind of like in a price war with some other companies in the market. And everybody right. is in that phase where they're just slashing prices like every week, you know, to try to one-up each other. So the price of the Commodore 64 is like plummeting, which kind of means like any potential of the market for this to stay in, you know, like underneath the Commodore 64 is just not going to happen because the Commodore 64 is becoming affordable. So yeah, I think that's why it didn't take off, but just see, it feels like kind of a weird time to do this, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Commodore was looking at 1982 and they're like, we should do the Max Machine 64 and the sequel to The Pet in the same year.
Like, what? It's like they had different teams working on it, and they're like, wait, what do you mean they're all ready right now?
Yeah. Exactly. All right, but with that being said, Wes, we have actual games we need to talk about today. Some good games, as a matter of fact. So let's take a short break, and we'll head on over into the timeline.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Let's hop into our timeline for today. We are going to start things off with a console we haven't seen for quite a little bit, the Odyssey 2. This is our second and final batch of Odyssey 2 games for 1982. Again, these are some that we don't really have firm month dates for, so we just break it up in the year. The first one that we're going to mention is The Mousing Cat, which was a strange cat and mouse maze chase type game, kind of as the name implies. And this one actually only came out on the video pack version of the Odyssey 2.
Yep, that is the that European version of it. This next one actually only came out on the Odyssey 2, which is the NA version. It's called Attack of the Time Lord, otherwise known as Terrahawks. I believe this is just another Galaxian type game, but it did have like some kind of digitized speech element, which I thought was kind of cool, but nothing we haven't seen before.
And then we have Frogger by Konami and probably Parker Bros as well, because it's the first third-party released game that we've seen for the Odyssey 2, and it's a pretty decent version of it too. And this one, you know, maybe because it was that third-party release, it actually did come out on both the Odyssey 2 and the video pack.
That's funny. Like, Konami's like, oh yeah, this is a great time to hop into the Odyssey 2 market. Like, this has got about to collapse in like 3 months.
How could they know?
I'm sure nothing will happen. All right, this next one is, again, only for the video pack. It's called the C710 Chess Module. And this is the first like weird extra hardware peripheral for the Odyssey 2. Came with like a chess board, I believe. But the Odyssey 2 like hooked up to it somehow. I don't really know how it worked. But basically, it just plays chess. But it, I don't know. It had some extra hardware components. And then the last one here is Nimble Numbers Ned, Sid the Spellbinder, and Type and Tell. These came out for the Odyssey 2 only and were three educational math and spelling type games that all had digitized speech with them using like a special hardware accessory as well. They just had simple mini games that awarded you for learning, but not great as actual video games, you know, more of an educational thing. But that will do it for us for the Odyssey 2 for this year. Can't say it was a great year for the Odyssey 2, but
it's feeling like an aging piece of hardware at this point, you know. But something we can always count on, at least for the next couple of years, I think, is arcade games. And that's where we're moving to next. My first review for today is an awesome looking game with a great name called Satan's Hollow by Midway. And everything we're talking about today, as long as we have month dates for it, did come out in October. So this game, I mean, the cabinet is just awesome. It's got like great gothic art of Lucifer, the devil himself on it, and a great marquee with the name Satan's Hollow. The art for this cabinet, I found out while I was doing a little bit of research on this, was actually done by a guy named Paul Niemeyer, or Niemeyer, I'm not sure, who went on to design the original Mortal Kombat logo, like the iconic Mortal Kombat logo. So
that's cool.
This guy's just cranking out the good designs. And I believe he worked on like Super Pac-Man or something. I don't know. So maybe not all of them were hits, but I can say Satan's Hollow for sure. Pretty awesome. Satan's Hollow also features the classic song Ride of the Valkyries when you make it in the boss stage and at the beginning of the game, which is pretty sweet. this game did catch some attention from, you know, like the sort of Bible crowd for being blatantly demonic in theme. I don't think it was a popular enough game that it got mass outrage or anything like that, but, you know, it's got the devil just right on the front there, so it was definitely catching attention in 1982.
Yeah, but don't you shoot the devil in this game? I feel like they should be all about it.
That's true, you know? They really should be like, oh, okay, this is righteous, but who knows? You got to get them to come play it first. Maybe that was the hard part.
Yeah.
Let me talk about the gameplay for Satan's Hollow. It is a classic Galaxian-style game with a unique bridge-building element mixed into it. You know, it's got the basics, like you move left and right on the bottom of the screen, and you shoot up at enemies that move around in sort of squiggly patterns, and then shoot down at you, and then also dive bomb into you. Very much like the movement of Galaxian, although there wasn't like the classic army at the top of the screen, it was more just they're always constantly moving. And after defeating a certain number of enemies, or it might even be every enemy, a bridge piece appears in the bottom left of the screen that you have to fly over and then drag to the right side of the screen where there's a lava river that you need to build this bridge over to cross into the boss stage. So occasionally, while you're on this main stage, you're fighting gargoyles mostly that drop projectiles on you, but then you also occasionally have a stage where this like floating head of a devil that shoots giant pillars of flame down at you comes in. And when you kill that, you get a bridge piece as well. And then after you complete the bridge, you cross over to the other side of the stage, which is really interesting. It's like the stage just kind of slides to the right instead of fully loading like a new looking stage. And Ride of the Valkyrie starts playing. Lucifer shows up and he tosses down golden tridents at you and moves very quickly. But just like everything else in this game, interestingly, is only one shot to kill. So it's more just the fact that he is moving all over the place that makes him difficult. But after you kill him, you go back to the main stage. It kind of resets, and then it takes more pieces to build the bridge. The lava river gets wider, and you keep looping until you lose your lives. And as I was playing this, I realized that the Lucifer boss stage is actually kind of optional. Building the bridge is sort of just a way to get bonus points because you can keep progressing through the other stage of gargoyles and demon heads, and it keeps adding flags to the top of the castle that just increase your bonus score once you eventually do go to fight Lucifer. So it was an interesting thing where I'm pretty sure you could go through the whole game without ever fighting him, but he gives you tons of points if you do. But that's the basic gameplay, you know, tons of Galaxian stuff we've seen before, so I'm going to get into my ratings for this now. Graphics is the big one here, and that's the main reason that we wanted to review this. It looks fantastic. So good, in fact, I gave it a 4.75 out of 10, still really high for this time. Satan's Hollow is just so cool. One of my favorite things about it is that it's got a fantastically detailed background with tons of color and shading, showing like this precarious cliff path that leads to an ominous castle in the distance. The sky background is also really well detailed with dark clouds, and as you're playing, the color slowly changes from like blue to a dark red with stars showing in it. Really kind of gives you that demonic Lucifer devil kind of feel with the red in the sky. And it's interesting too that it doesn't, I feel like lots of games it would be like around ends and then the sky changes, but this it's kind of just slowly changing as time goes on, which feels really smooth compared to a lot of previous games that we've played. The enemies also look fantastic, really well detailed sprites. There's the floating devil head that shoots fire down, and the fire looks awesome. And then the gargoyles, which are the main enemies, look like weird pterodactyls, to be honest. But they're still really well detailed, cool looking sprite that has a bunch of different sprites for all the different directions that they can move, which works well in this type of game where they're doing loop-de-loops and dive bombing. Honestly, the most disappointing part of the visuals for me was your ship, which I thought was a catapult, but you're making laser sounds. It kind of looks spacey, so I don't really know what the heck's going on there. And then also Lucifer himself, like the demon head looks so strange and awesome, but you go to Lucifer and it's just a full body, very tiny red guy, basically T-posing in the sky and just flies around with no animation at all. Like just side strafing, throwing tridents at you. It's so strange. Like on the cabinet, he has these huge big demon wings. And if that was in the game, I feel like it would make him so much more intimidating. But as it is, he really feels like side content compared to the gargoyles and the big demon head. The bridge that you're building over and the lava also just look okay, but all in all, I mean, that background especially looks so good that I had to rate it really highly. Moving on to sounds now, I gave this a 3 out of 10. You've got Ride of the Valkyries playing at the beginning of the game and whenever you fight Lucifer, but unfortunately that's the only music in the whole game. It's really good, but I really would have loved some more chill background music or something going on while you're fighting during the main rounds. The sound effects are pretty good, though. It's all a little bit spacey, which felt kind of weird, and I think they did pull like some of the mechanics of this from a Tron cabinet that they had done previously, so maybe there's some carryover there. But overall, there's still a lot of sound going on that's pretty decent, and it feels fairly full, so even without the music, it was still pretty good. Moving on to gameplay now, I gave this a 4 out of 10. It may just be another Galaxian shooter, but I really liked the added mechanics of bridge building and the optional Lucifer boss. You got nice things like having two bullets on screen at once too, and also a really cool mechanic of a shield button, which isn't limited use per game, but it's just a meter that drains and then refills when you aren't using it. The shield is just so fun because you get to it's kind of balanced around that. You get the points in the game where like five enemies dive bomb you at exactly the same time. But if you time the shield right, you just blow them all up as soon as they hit you. So it leads to some really satisfying and frustrating moments. But overall, the shield felt really cool. I really liked having the additional objective of building the bridge too, because it kind of keeps you moving across the screen, makes it about more than just killing waves and waves of enemies. You also have this bonus score. And like I mentioned, the scoring goes up after each round that you win. A flag is placed on top of the castle in the background. And when you kill Lucifer, you get bonus points for how many flags are on the castle. So that also means, you know, the game doesn't totally loop once you beat Lucifer. It still keeps incrementing in the stages. So you can get tons of points the further into the game that you beat him. And that's why the lava bridge kind of gets harder to build over. That being said, it is still a really hard game, but I found that I still had a great time with it. It scratches that Galaxian itch for me while also adding some new gameplay. Love to see it. Relevance now, I couldn't go too high on this. I gave this a 6.5 out of 10. I don't think this is the first game that Paul Niemeyer worked on for Midway, but I feel like you gotta recognize the future Mortal Kombat artist for doing this like devilish game. It just seems super cool. And the mechanics feel really novel for a Galaxian game, so I wanted to give it some credit there. And overall, that left me with a 4 out of 10 for Satan's Hollow. It's a beautiful looking game with a super unique theme and fun gameplay to boot. Added to the ever-growing list of cabinets I'd like to own because this one is so sick and so cool. Who doesn't love a little bit of fire and brimstone, you know? It's super cool.
All right, nice, man.
But yeah, Satan's Hollow, I'm glad to say, you know, we both saw it and we're like, this looks killer. Glad to say it's fun as well.
Yeah. All right, good. And I bet the bridge mechanic is kind of interesting because I guess it takes away some of your like navigable area, right? When the bridge isn't built.
Yes.
To kind of move around. So that's kind of interesting.
The later stages are pretty tough when the lava bridge gets, you know, it's taking up like a quarter of your screen because there's more enemies and much less space to move around. So yeah, that's a very good point.
Interesting. I guess if you try to move where the bridge is not, you fall in the lava.
I think it actually just blocks you, thankfully. Like you just can't move over it because I've definitely was like mashing buttons and didn't fall into the lava ever. So
okay, good.
I'll take that. Yeah.
All right, cool. All right, well, Wes, well, from one amazing game to the next one.
Okay.
It's my first review. It's called Flyboy by Kaneko. Not Coleco, Kaneko.
Interesting.
This came out in October and is a game about paragliding, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, in this game, you've got, I guess it's, is it called a parasail? I don't even know. You're not connected to a rope, like, you know, connected to a boat, which is what I think of parasailing. I don't know, but yeah. You're just like in the air with like a, you know, a glider.
Hang glider. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, hang glider. But weirdly, you know, like, I think one of the core mechanics of hang gliding is like you can't just fly forever, but you can in this game. There's not really gravity in this game. But this game, I don't know, it kind of plays like a dodging type game, I guess, where you've got some enemies on screen in the form of like airplanes and birds, helicopters, that kind of stuff. Also weird nature obstacles like clouds can kill you, which I found out about the hard way. Also in some stages, there's just like weird, I don't know, almost geometric shapes. I don't know. It's not always very cohesive with the art style. But basically for most of these enemies, you can either just A, dodge them, or you can actually kind of swat them away, bat them away. You do that by hitting a button and your guy will kind of like flap his legs like a maniac. And if you are like above the enemy, you can kind of kick it down, kick it away from you, and usually they will crash like into the ground. So that's like your main mechanic. You're just trying to survive and not get hit. And you can either do that again just by dodging or by kind of kicking away the enemies, which is usually a good thing because the enemies in this game, they don't like chase you like in a Galaxian game. It's more like they have patterns that they do on screen, whether it's like a big loop-de-loop or whatever. So if you can kick it out of the sky, especially at the beginning, once it kind of comes into the screen, then you don't have to worry about enemies for a while because that enemy would have done like three patterns and then left the screen and then before the next enemy comes. So if you can kick it out of the area, then you can save yourself some dodging, which is cool. But yeah, otherwise you're just trying to kind of go for a while. The game kind of takes place on three main stages, I guess. The first stage, I think they call it the Alps, but I mean, it's just kind of like flying over forest areas with occasional like little bridge, tiny little mountain, and a little train like underneath of you. Pretty much all the background elements of this game take up only like the bottom 15% of the screen. Like the majority of the screen is just a blue sky where the enemies and you chill at. But yeah, so, you know, in the Alps section, it's kind of mountainy, I guess, but the mountains are very small. And then you go to more of a beach coastal stage with slightly different enemies, but you fly over the ocean and islands and also an aircraft carrier, which is on the aircraft carrier seems to be like biplanes from the 1920s, which I don't know if that makes sense.
Right.
And finally, the third stage is like in Egypt and you've got the pyramids in the background, which is kind of interesting. And like the Sphinx and stuff. So that was probably my favorite stage. But yeah, at the end of every stage, you have to actually land your flight. It's kind of weird how it does it. Like, you fly for a while and then it's like, okay, you've got 10 seconds to land your guy down on the ground. And there's like these little landing platforms that remind me of a lunar lander, right? That you have to land on. But if you miss one and fly over it, there's a couple more. And actually, as the time ticks down and you skip more and more landing pads, I think the bonus points get increasingly high to kind of incentivize you playing risky with the time. But if you don't land in the time, then you crash. So you kind of want to try to maybe skip a couple and then land. Kind of one of the overarching gameplay mechanics as you're doing all this is that you are hang gliding. And the movement of that isn't as simple as just like being in a spaceship. So there is a little bit of physics applied to your glider where it kind of just like bounces up and down in a very routine fashion that you can kind of get the feel of. But then in addition to that bouncing up and down kind of motion, you can apply your own directional commands to it. So like when it's going up and you hit the up button, it'll go up faster in that period, but if it's going down and you hit up, it kind of just barely goes up or it just stays the same, you know? So it's kind of like combining your direction with the natural bob of this this glider. It sounds kind of complicated, but honestly, you know, the bobbing motion is fairly minimal, so I didn't really feel like it impacted me too much. And fortunately, like I mentioned, the enemies aren't really attacking you per se. They're just kind of doing their thing. So even though you move kind of clumsily, the screen is big enough that you can usually stay away from the enemies for the most part. So I didn't think it was overly hard to use, really. But yeah, with all that being said, I think I'll get into my ratings. Let's start out with the gameplay. You know, it's not like this game's bad, and I think that's going to be the case for pretty much all my ratings. But at the same time, I just didn't really enjoy it that much. I didn't think it was that interesting. You know, it was just kind of the same thing over and over again. You can't really attack unless you actively put yourself in harm's way, which seems like a bad idea. Otherwise, you're just dodging and, like I said, you're kind of messing with these movement controls, but I didn't think it was that like difficult to learn. And there's just really nothing that interesting about it. It just felt kind of boring to me, honestly. So, like, I don't think it's bad. I gave the gameplay a 3.25 out of 10, but it's also just kind of maybe a little safe, a little kind of standard and not that interesting. So I kind of got bored of it, so couldn't go too high. With the graphics, I mean, there's some things that I really like about the graphics, like the three different stages. They have different enemies and they have their own theme and styles. But like I mentioned before, a lot of the screen is just a single color background, and that's not that interesting. So there's a give and a take to it when it comes to the graphics. I think your actual flyboy on the glider, he's pretty weird looking, man. He's got his mouth open the whole time, like he's super excited about what's going on. And like the proportions are all like out of whack, where like the airplanes are smaller than your glider and like the aircraft carrier is larger than the mountains in the Alps. It's like, I don't know. It's there's some weird stuff here. There's some also really bad color palettes where like the sky is like bright pink at times.
Okay.
So, I don't know. I didn't think it was bad again, but I didn't think it was great either. I gave it a 3.25 as well. There is a lot of animation, a lot of multicolored sprites. So, and I do like when you do the kicking animation. He's definitely like freaking out when you do that animation. It's kind of funny though. And then for the sound effects, kind of same story here. You do have two voice harmony the whole time. And if it was just music playing in the background this whole time, I think I would actually rate it pretty highly because I think the music's pretty good. It's like kind of jolly upbeat music. That's kind of fast-paced sounding, and I like it. I thought it was good, and it plays the whole time, which is really nice. But the actual like sound effects for what you do are just horrible to listen to. They remind me of like squeaking noises, you know, like squeaking of plastic or something. Like, it's just not pleasant to listen to, and they happen all the time. Pretty much whenever your guy like bobs upwards, it does this. So it kind of just ruined the music a bit for me and made it just not that fun to listen to. So I didn't go too high with the sound effects. I went 3 out of 10 because you do have music the whole time, which is good. But I think it's hard to listen to the music when the sound effects are so annoying. So couldn't go too high there. For relevance, unfortunately, I have to give this like a 3 out of 10 because I couldn't even find a flyer to this game. I don't think really many people know about this game, and I don't think it inspired anything. But it does have a couple clones, which we'll talk about, so I didn't want to give it like a 1. But yeah, I don't think it's all that relevant. Overall, that left me with a 3.25 out of 10. And that's not like a bad score. You know, again, compared to like games that we did from last year, I think this would have been pretty good, but it's just kind of a boring game to me, like boring game loop that I didn't have that much fun with. And, you know, we've just been humbled with all the amazing games that we've been playing lately that when something that's just okay comes along, we're like, well, it's not great. You know,
yeah.
It's not pole position, but like it's decent. It's just kind of not that interesting, I guess.
Yeah, that seems fair. It's got some solid scores all around. It's just not a standout. And hey,
yeah,
you know, that's okay, I guess. But like you said, there were a couple clones for it. We have Fast Freddy by Atari and Big Flyer by Taito Brazil. All right, but next we have another arcade game that I got to take a look at today. Boy, I'm getting spoiled with these arcade game reviews. My second review for today, it is Dark Planet by Stern. Very interested about this one because we saw videos of it and we're just like, what the heck is even going on? And also, I feel like it's one of the first times since Berserk we've seen Stern be like, let's do something that isn't Berserk, really.
Sure.
You know, because this is, you know, you're shooting in all directions, but it controls kind of differently in Dark Planet. So there is some interesting background to it. Thankfully, you know, we haven't seen All in Color for a Quarter blog for a while. He usually does older arcade game stuff, but he had an article on this. So I think, what's the other name of the blog?
Golden Age Arcade Historian, yeah.
Yeah. So he did a great write-up on this game with some background information that I am thankfully using his research. And Dark Planet was originally the idea of an artist named Eric Erickson. Sounds fake, but it's real. He had been working on toys and video games for this company called Marvin Glass and Associates before they stopped their video game production. He kind of started the idea for video game production there. So after that, he said, I'm out of here, left with one of his coworkers to make his own game company and game concept, which was a 3D battle with aliens on the surface of an asteroid. Apparently, he was pretty inspired by the scene in Star Wars where the Millennium Falcon flies into the asteroid. He didn't know how to program, though, when he made this idea, but he wanted to demo the machine. So apparently he like built the machine without it actually having any of like the working parts a video game would need, and recorded videos that mimicked real graphics and then played the videos so that at demos it looked like real graphics, which seems like almost harder than programming. But I guess if you don't know how to program at all, hey, why not go for it? Stern Electronics was interested in this. The president of Stern actually came down and like saw in these guys' basement the demo that they had, and he picked it up right away. And over the next year, the game that was going to become Dark Planet was developed. The game simulated 3D with mirrored visuals reflected on a painted background, which we've definitely seen before, but it also added some other elements to add to that 3D-ness of it. It had an actual 3D model, like part of an asteroid on the top of the screen to make it look like, you know, just beyond your view is where the asteroid was curving off into the distance. And then it also had graphics that were red and blue for all the actual graphics on screen, because the game was played while looking through a red and blue film, like classic 3D glasses. So you actually played this game looking through like this rectangular viewport to get that 3D visual effect. And because of that, the cabinet looked really unique. It had some great colorful art on the sides, and obviously this really weird, like, sunken-in screen that you're looking at behind a viewport. But now let me get into the gameplay for Dark Planet. It is a pretty weird and complex game. It controls sort of like Asteroids, where you rotate your ship, but then there's a separate button for thrust, which is not my favorite, but I'll get into that later. And the game takes place on two, like, horizontal planes, basically. The view is top-down into the asteroid crater, but anything that's colored blue on the screen is higher up than it looks. It's in the upper atmosphere, and anything that's red is actually on, like, the ground of the asteroid crater. You have to destroy three enemy bases that are shown in the painted background on the crater's surface. In the top left of the screen, there's a tube that you can fly into that takes you up and down the planes. So it either takes you to the upper atmosphere, or if you're in the upper atmosphere and flying through the tube, it takes you down to the crater's surface. And you basically have two different ways of attacking. When you're up above, you can bomb, but then you can also shoot straight in front of you. And when you're on the crater's surface, you can do both as well. Although bombing, I don't think does anything because it's directly below you and there's only the ground below you. But you can also shoot straight in front of you. And I believe the only way you can blow up the bases is by going to the crater's surface and actually shooting the base doors. While you're trying to shoot the bases, though, enemies come out to try and attack you occasionally. There's a few different types. One of the enemy ship that chases you has to use the tube to get to the higher level, so it'll either be red or blue, depending on which level it's on, and then you know whether you need to bomb it or shoot it when it's in front of you. And there's also what they call laser trains that have like these sort of like worker drones that build a track for them to follow. And then they'll just keep following that track continuously, shooting lasers into the upper atmosphere occasionally. The way they do that effect is pretty cool because the train's red because it's always on the ground. But when it shoots its projectile, it's always blue to indicate that it's above the train. And then also in the right of the screen, there's a volcano that erupts every now and then. When it does erupt, it shoots fire in this big circle in the upper atmosphere, but it won't affect you if you're down on the ground. Yeah, basically you're going back and forth between these two horizontal planes, bombing, shooting, avoiding enemies, trying to blow up all the base doors. And that, I feel like, is very convoluted. I will say Arcade USA has a great video where he explains how the game works and then plays through it. Definitely watch that if you want a little bit more explanation. But with that being said, let me get into my ratings for Dark Planet. For graphics, I gave it a 4 out of 10. I mean, I'm saying graphics here, but it's kind of hard to rate this without talking about everything else that's going on. Like, just the visuals, just the graphics on the screen alone, not that much. But when you're talking about the background, that's a cool painted background with lots of details in the crater, from the volcano to the bases, you know, all feels very Star Wars-y, like the inspiration. The models of the asteroid that are actually outside the screen also look great and give it this cool 3D effect. And I think the red-blue viewport part of the screen that gives it that extra 3D effect is also really cool and unique. Unfortunately, I can't really say how well that 3D viewport worked with the graphics because there's some videos of the actual cabinet, but it can't really do it justice. Looking through, you know, a video camera through a screen onto another screen just doesn't really work. But it looks really cool, and I'd love to play one in real life to see what it looks at. As for the actual, like, rendered graphics on the screen, they're pretty simple. They're only blue or red, like I mentioned, but the sprites all look pretty good. The train following the tracks and shooting up above it looks really cool. The enemy ships look a lot like Y-Wings from Star Wars, but they still look really cool. Your ship just looks okay, but when you destroy a base, some of the, like, flickering flames show up on the door, which is pretty sweet. So altogether, it's a really cool visual package. Moving on to sounds now, though, this is unfortunately not quite as exciting. The sounds are basically just what you would expect from an Asteroids or Galaxian game, just a lot of laser sounds. They at least have some decent bass to them, but they aren't super original. Unfortunately, just lots of beeps, some explosions, the volcano eruption, but no music and nothing else too impressive. And now talking about gameplay a little bit, as cool as this game looks, I gotta say, it plays a little bland. I really wish you could change from the upper atmosphere to the crater surface with the push of a button instead of flying to this tube on the top of the screen. It just felt really cumbersome and weird. I guess it might make the game too easy if you could do that, but it also made it impossible to play on emulated versions because you don't have the painted background, so you don't even know where the travel tube is. But anyway, you can figure that out a little bit by watching videos of other people. The enemy ships felt kind of too fast for the Asteroids type controls. I found myself just either missing whenever I shot at them or flying into them all the time. I definitely think it would be easier with a joystick, but still didn't feel ideal movement-wise. I never really liked that Asteroids-type movement. I do think the trains are really fun, though. I like that you can blow up the tracks that they're on so that the train kind of stops and has to move in a different direction. And then you can, you know, go down to the crater surface and shoot them more easily. And the volcano, I think, is a fun random element. Gives you less screen to play with and just looks pretty cool. The general goal of destroying the bases also feels pretty cool at first, but I think that's all you do as the game repeats. And because it's the bases are on the painted background, it's not like they can ever add new bases. It's always the same ones over and over again. So it all just felt a little clunky, still pretty good overall, though. So I left it at a 3 out of 10. For relevance, I can only give this a 4 out of 10. As cool and unique as the cabinet is, it was too expensive to produce, so it never actually went into full production, and I think only 350 units were ever made of Dark Planet. Stern did continue to try to make 3D games in the future, but I don't think those are going to be super popular either, so I don't think Dark Planet itself was super relevant. And overall, that left me with a 3 out of 10. The design and the idea behind Dark Planet are awesome, and like I said, I would love to play one in real life to see how those 3D elements actually play out. But behind that crazy design, there's still just some okay sounds and some pretty original but kind of unfortunately boring gameplay. Overall, I still think it's really cool and one that's worth taking a look at playing, but when I saw how frantic and confusing the gameplay was, I was hoping it would be just a little bit more in depth than it actually turned out to be.
All right. Well, I'm pretty surprised with us. I didn't know any of those mechanics when we gave it to you.
Neither did I, right? We looked at it, thought it looked cool, and then I'm like, okay, there's multiple levels. There's what the heck? And thank goodness for Arcade USA, or I never would have known what was going on.
So there's definitely some complexity to it.
Yeah.
Too bad it didn't result in it being more fun necessarily, but not a bad one, though. It had interesting stuff going on.
Yeah.
And again, would love to have this cabinet with all the crazy stuff going on the insides. Would be really cool to play in real life, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But let's move on. We're going to get out of arcade games for a while and move on to some computer games, starting with this next one by MicroProse Software. It's called Floyd of the Jungle, and this one's actually by Sid Meier, who up until now has been doing mainly flight sim games, I think. But this is actually a platformer with four-player support set in a jungle-type theme. It was pretty cool, but it ran a little bit slow because it was on the Atari 8-bit.
And then we have Pie Man by Penguin Software, which is a game about baking pies on a time limit. It honestly had some overcooked kind of vibes, although honestly much simpler. Still pretty cool to see, though, and this one came out on the Apple II.
All right, and that's going to hop us into my second review of the day. It's the game called Dungeon, also known as Dungeon the Computer Adventure Game, by TRS the Game Wizards for the Apple II, which came out sometime in 1982. Now, if you're like me, you've probably never heard of TRS the company before, but TRS actually invented the game Dungeons and Dragons. They are the Dungeons and Dragons people. They would later get bought up by Wizards of the Coast, so now they're known as Wizards of the Coast. But this is the company that owns D&D. So they're branching off into some actual video game tie-in games now, which people have been copying D&D on computers for like years now. So about time they actually tried to enter the market themselves. Unfortunately, I don't think it really made a splash, and they would end up just licensing D&D for the next couple of years, I think. But this is a pretty important game for a couple of different reasons. I'll talk about them, I think, mostly in the relevance section, but as far as what this game is, it's not a D&D game, necessarily, as far as like the D&D mechanics that we would expect. You know, when I think we were looking at it, Wes, I thought it was a CRPG or some kind of RPG game, mm-hmm. but it's not. I'm just going to call them Wizards of the Coast, because that's how I think about them now. But they basically made a D&D offshoot board game called Dungeon sometime, I think in 82 or maybe a couple years before, but it's an actual board game with a fantasy theming to it. the board game itself actually looks awesome, and I definitely want it, Wes, to play it with you, because I think it just would be really fun. But this game for the Apple II, also called Dungeon, is basically a one-to-one conversion of the board game, and they tried to just, let's just put the board game on a computer, you know? that's all they wanted to do. So I'm going to try to explain the board game pretty much as best I can, and that it's pretty much exactly the same for the computer game. But essentially, this is a like 2 to 8 player game. In the game, your main goal is to collect treasure from this giant overworld map that's full of hallways, but then also rooms. And inside every room is a monster, but also a piece of treasure. There can be some other stuff like different goodies or traps, but that's mostly what you're going to find. When you start the game, there's like 4 different classes you can pick from. Now, there's a maximum of, since there's 8 players total that can play, you cannot have more than 2 people pick the same class, since there's 4 classes, to ensure everybody plays a different class, pretty much. But the classes play very differently, so it kind of makes replaying the game be fun. The 4 classes, you've got like an elf kind of class. They have the weakest combat stats, but can kind of traverse the game board a little bit easier, mainly through unlocking certain doors. So that's how they can win. Also, because they don't have a lot of combat potential, they have a different winning condition. They don't have to collect as much gold as the other classes to win. So that kind of might make them be your class of choice, if you will. You also have what they call heroes and superheroes, which are just kind of more warrior classes. They have a little bit more attack and power, but they also require more gold to win. And finally, you have a like wizard class, who is the only one that can really like cast spells, which is kind of its own unique mechanic in the game. But they require the most gold to win. Interestingly, the actual game board is divided into 6 different unique sections. And in each section, there's different levels of monster found in that section. So like in the level 1 section, that's where your elf character is going to want to go, because there's low level creatures there and they have a small amount of gold, you know, that they drop compared to the larger creatures. But that's okay, because the elf character doesn't need as much gold. Whereas like the wizard, who's the most powerful character, wants to go like to the hardest part of the dungeon and farm there, because they're going to drop the most gold and that's how they're going to win. So you've got like kind of a game board and 4 different characters that kind of go in different areas of the game board, at least in the beginning. They can't really interact with each other at all. Like, you can't do any PvP in the game, but there is some PvP type scenarios that can come up. So imagine this, if you will. Whenever you go into an actual combat with a character, you basically just roll 2 die, and if it's above a certain number, you win the combat. You know, and if it's below by like 2, you get what's called wounded, which means like you drop some of your treasure into that room, you get kicked out of the room, and you lose a turn, and then it's the other people's turn to go. But you can also, if you do really badly in a combat, you can like kind of die, where you drop all of your treasure in that room. And then you have to start back in like the center of the map. So if you can imagine a scenario where, like, let's say I'm the wizard, I've got 20,000 gold, I need 40,000. Well, the elf character had 20, they were going for 30, because that's what they need to win, but they just died. I might try to run to the room that they died in to steal their loot to then win that way. And so you can have these kind of mad dashes for whenever somebody dies to go and claim that loot. And even if like that means you're an elf character and you have to go into the hard part of the dungeon, if it means like you're either doing that or you've got no chance and you just lose the game, you might as well try. There's always a chance, right? So there can be some funny scenarios where everybody's kind of going into rooms that they're not shouldn't be in, and keep getting wounded or dying, and the money in there is just growing and growing. So there's some kind of interesting mechanics there. But yeah, the actual combat of this game is very trivial. Like, it's kind of it kind of all plays out by itself, minus the wizard, who has to select between 1 of 2 different spells. I can't really tell. I think the spells just have different attack amounts or something like that. and have a limited number to them as far as how many you can cast. But mostly it's just like die rolls. So if you can imagine like this game on computer, you know, why would you play it on computer as opposed to the board game? You know, it's going to keep track of certain things like your inventory, how many treasures you have, which rooms have already been in, what a monster spawns in them. It kind of does a lot of the tedious work of the board game for you, which is nice. It also has some graphical animations. So like when you play the board game version and you fight like a goblin, you have like a goblin card, right? And it's got a little artwork of a goblin on it, but that otherwise you just roll die. But in this game, it kind of takes you to like this combat screen and puts you into the dungeon and shows your character versus the goblin. I think if you have any character other than the wizard, there's no animations, but the wizard, when you cast a spell, he casts the fireball and the lightning bolt at him. And that's kind of cool. It's a really nice animation, and the artwork for this game is like way better than it has any right to be for the Apple II. It's like whoever did the artwork for this game needs to be hired by Sierra Online to do their characters, because the characters in this game are way better than like anything in a graphical text adventure. So like the artwork for this is great. I think the map screen, the map on the board game is really detailed and fairly large. So for the computer game version, it couldn't display the entire map on screen at the same time. So each kind of area of the dungeon is its own separate screen in the computer version. That does mean that each section can be kind of blown up a little bit to make it easier to see, but you can't see the entire map on screen at any given time, which can be confusing if you don't know where to go. Like, you know, where is the hard part of the dungeon at? I think that was in the manual, but you know, that's the only like minor complaint. Like that, like the overworld part of the dungeon doesn't look the best, but when you're in the combat part, it looks amazing. So, but yeah, otherwise, I don't know. Like, I think I'm going to compare this to the board game a lot. So let me do that. I'll get in my ratings and talk about it. Let's start off with the graphics. As I mentioned, I think it's one of the high points about the game because it puts you into that combat. It makes you feel like you're in a dungeon and you're actually versing actual enemies. I think it's one of the better parts about the game. I gave it a 3.25 just because, you know, the combat is somewhat sporadic. Like, you spend more time on the overworld screen than you do in the combat screens. And the overworld screen is just like a bunch of squares and rectangles with different colors to them. Like, it's not that interesting. Not a whole lot of detail there. The combat does look amazing. And you fight all sorts of different things, from like lizards to dragons to like knights and goblins and stuff. So lots of really cool fights and combat here, but it's a bit of a mixed bag on the Apple II at the same time. So I couldn't go too high, but still, I think that's a pretty good score for the Apple II. I'm sorry, I said 3.25. I actually gave it a 3.5. So nice. I really like the graphics for this. The sound effects, they did not try there. Like, you would think that would be like the one thing like computer could really add to a board game is some sound effects. But there's no sound in this game, just occasional beeps for like entering a room. Like, it's pretty much silent the whole time. So it's just not good. So I give it a 0.5 because I guess there's something, but it's pretty much no sound. And then for gameplay, I gave it a 3 out of 10. Honestly, I couldn't really see myself playing this over the board game, because if you have other people you're playing with, you don't want to be sitting around like one computer trying to play a game. I think it would be annoying. Yeah. And part of the fun of playing board games is like rolling the die. Like, that's fun. But having the computer roll the die is just like, feels more like RNG random chance. So I guess I'm dead now. So I don't think I would play it over the board game. I guess if you didn't own the board game, this would be pretty good. And like I said, there are some nice things. It does simplify a bit of the logistics and keeps track of certain things. Like, it's a good board game adaptation. I just don't think it's better than the board game. So I couldn't go that high with the gameplay. Although if you didn't have the board game, I think you'd find this pretty fun as a party game. I don't think there's that many party games on computers in 82. So for that reason, it's not bad, but just not as good as the board game, which I want the board game. I think the board game it would be like an 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10. I think it'd be fun. So I'm going to look for that on eBay sometime. But yeah, just okay with the gameplay. Now for relevance, I kind of briefly mentioned it, but there is some history to this game. The game was actually designed by a guy named Bruce Naismith. And this guy, he worked for TSR, who is Wizards of the Coast, and made D&D. And they actually pulled out of the computer game business after these couple games here in 82 and 83. And he ended up working on like D&D campaign books for the next 10 years, including some of their best selling and all time best, you know, D&D books, including the Ravenloft campaign setting, just like so many different books and additions to Dungeons and Dragons, which then influenced everybody else. Right. So that in itself is pretty important. But after he was at TSR for over 10 years making these books, he decided to go back into computer gaming. And he ended up joining Bethesda and ended up being a quest designer for the Elder Scrolls games, including Elder Scrolls Oblivion and Morrowind. He did quest design on Fallout 3, Fallout 4, Fallout 76. He ended up being the lead game designer for Elder Scrolls 5 Skyrim. So he's got some pretty big credits there for Bethesda for some of their best games that they've ever made. So, yeah, this guy's pretty important and has a pretty long career. And yeah, it's just cool to see him in here. I mean, I think as far as like taking a board game and putting it into a computer game, you can't get much better than this. Like it is just the board game, a 1-for-1 adaptation with some improvements in certain areas that make it better than board game in some areas. So like I think it was a total success in terms of conversion. I just still don't think it's enough to be better than the board game quite yet. If the overworld looked better and it was easier, like if the internet had existed, I think it would have been better, you know, because then you could just play online with your friends. But obviously, people have to share an Apple II to play this. And in that context, I don't think it's quite as good. But still, I mean, it's a great one, and I'm glad I looked at it. It's super different and cool. So yeah, check out Dungeon. I'm definitely going to check out the board game and see if I can find it somewhere. I think we definitely got to play it if I can find it, Wes.
Did you say what your overall score was for this?
Oh, I'm sorry. My overall score, I gave it a 2.25. Yeah, the sound really dragged it down there.
Yeah.
Because you need to have some sound. I mean, come on. We're fighting like dragons here. You can't give me a swinging swoosh sound or something? Come on.
Yeah. But yeah, definitely sounds cool. And like you said, hey man, if you find that board game, I'm in. I'm ready.
Yeah. I think the board game would be super fun. All right, but we've got a couple more here. Let's keep it going.
Yeah, so the next one we have is SEUIS, which I looked up and stands for Shoot 'em Up in Space. By
makes sense.
SSI, and which is Strategic Simulations. And it was for the Apple II, and it's another strategy game from them, this time with space theming. Changes up the combat to a more kind of contained arcade real-time style in certain action segments, which is pretty cool. So nice to see some more variety and exciting gameplay than the previous games. And you still have that turn-based strategy map view that we're used to seeing from them.
All right, kind of cool. This next one is also for the Apple II. It came out sometime in 1982. It's called Transylvania by Penguin Software and was a graphical text adventure with some great graphics and obviously set in that horror type theme, which I'm a big fan of. So I got to shout him out.
Oh, yeah. And next, we're going to wrap things up by talking about some ColecoVision games. First one we're going to mention here is Carnival. And for the ColecoVision, we do have month dates, so we know that these came out in October. Carnival, it's just exactly what the arcade game was, basically, which is just like a shooting gallery type game. So unfortunately, not that great.
I don't know what they're doing because ColecoVision, they just came out with the Smurf game, which I loved. And then they're like, let's clone an arcade game. Which one should we pick? One that has terrible graphics.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Why would you do that? The same thing here. Their next one is Ladybug, the arcade port of the game Ladybug. And Ladybug didn't have great graphics. It was basically Pac-Man with a ladybug. It's like,
yeah,
you've got an amazing piece of hardware here, guys. Come on. Can't you do Satan's Hollow or something?
Well, I think they did finally get the point, Ben, because the last game that we have to talk about today is Zaxxon for ColecoVision.
Now we're talking.
And I mean, We were thinking about covering this one, but basically, and this is a great credit to Coleco, the ColecoVision, it just kind of looks like the arcade game. So that's amazing for a console that it looks as good as the arcade game, because Zaxxon is also just an incredible looking game, but not much reason to review it. It's just more to say, dang, okay, I'm excited to see what else they bring over.
Oh, yeah. And we are not done with 1982 quite yet, so I'll have to see what else comes out from them. But we are done for today's episode. We checked out Satan's Hollow by Midway, a Galaxian-type game with a bridge-building mechanic, and also Satan himself was there. We destroyed him. And it was cool. It was a really cool one. I did Flyboy, which was kind of boring, I guess. But I guess it was somewhat unique as a paragliding-type game. And then you did Dark Planet, which was super weird and unique with a crazy visual setup that I was not expecting, but wasn't the best maybe. And then finally I did Dungeon, the computer adventure game by TRS, the Game Wizards. I thought it was really cool to check out. It was a board game converted to a computer game that played just as well as the board game, but I think still falls a little short. Had this come out in maybe 83, 84, it could have maybe said, it is better than the board game. It is, you know, worth it. But I don't think I'd quite say that. Still, it was a really great conversion that I think was successful. So, got to shout it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And interesting, we're still seeing those board game conversions, because that's definitely something we've seen before. Make sure to check out our website where we've got some good information on things we've covered before. But if you're enjoying these episodes, make sure to keep following us. You can check us out on X, where we post announcements about our episodes as they go up. And check out our YouTube channel, where we're posting some of our older episodes and also some head-to-head old school game action with me and Ben. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us and send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.